All right, everyone. Welcome back to Dialogue Not Division. It's been a couple weeks since we've had an episode. There's just been so much going on. I wanted to take a little bit of time to process things that are going on in the world. And as many of you are probably already aware, over the last couple of weeks, the trial of Derek Chauvin, the cop that famously kneeled on the neck of George Floyd, that trial has been going on. It's been all over in the news, and I've been trying to follow a lot of that lately and really just kind of dig into it, understand it better, understand the facts, understand why this issue seems to be so divisive right now. And this episode today, I wanted to talk a little bit about it, or primarily this episode is dedicated all to it, but I wanted to do it slightly different, in a different format than our previous episodes. A lot of our other episodes, we really dig into one issue, we look deeply into, or we try to look at some of the facts from both sides and really dig into that. I like to show stats, different things. This one more, I just wanted to share some maybe personal opinions, share my thoughts on the trial, on how things are going, as well as some of the division that's been going on. Because really, strangely enough, this has been, well, not really strangely, it's been highly politicized. And so, of course, it's been kind of polarizing to different individuals. And really, it's something that I don't think we have to make quite that polarizing. So with this, I've been following several different channels that have been covering this, some solely covering this. Some of them are just covering kind of the highlights of the channel. I've watched a little bit as well of the actual stream, but watching the full trial, it's quite long. It's often boring. There's a lot of administrative details there. When it comes to court cases, you spend a lot of time establishing baseline facts or baseline things that really don't go a lot into establishing guilt or innocence. It's kind of different things you have to establish and set the agreement on, so that when you start building on the logic or building on your cases onto that, everyone's on the same page. So there's a lot of that that goes on. So really, I have been, just to be honest, watching a lot of the highlights or the summaries from different channels. And one thing that I've noticed is it's quite divisive. Of course, this has been highly publicized. You see a lot of media attention, especially in the beginning. This was put as, you know, a pure murder of George Floyd. A lot of people are of that opinion. A lot of people still are of that opinion. And then other people, there's been a lot of dialogue on the other side where basically it said, basically, there's more to this story. We should look into it more and understand both. There was I think two celebrities, one celebrity that said, why even have a trial? It's on video. He's guilty. Just lock him away or whatever. And I think this is a good illustration, or this concept or this thing is why trials are important. Why one video angle or two video angles, it doesn't always tell the full story. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that before I dig into the kind of the controversy or some of the things I'm hearing. I did want to say I spent 6 years, quite a long time ago now. I think it's been 8 years ago. I spent 6 years as military police. I have had some training on this. As military police in the Air Force or security forces, you don't spend a whole lot of time doing the law enforcement mission. Always, you also do a lot of security, but you are trained law enforcement. We do go through a lot of the same training, a lot of the same concepts. You go through the arrest, apprehension, use of force, different of these concepts. So it does give me some personal firsthand knowledge. I've experienced some of these things. I've been in some of these situations firsthand. I wouldn't say I'm by any means an expert, and that's kind of why I don't want to dig super deep into a lot of the intricate details of either of the policy exactly, or of the legal case, because I'm an expert at neither. I do have a little bit more experience, I'd say, than the average person, in that I've actually been in law enforcement situations. I've had to deal with some of the chaotic things that happen, and may have to make some of those decisions, or even watch some bad decisions being made as the laws are enforced. So with that, I've been watching a couple different channels and noticed some of the dialogue going in. There's a lot of what I'd call not necessarily misinformation, but or information that's blown out of proportion, I would say, or there's a lot of polarizing stances people are trying to take on this. And what people aren't doing, or what I'm not seeing a lot of, is people really looking at both sides of this and trying to understand why this might be a polarizing topic. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. I went through and it was interesting, since there's so many different things that people aren't taking into account or understanding. I was on a couple videos on my personal YouTube account, and I made some comments. I commented to a few people. Most of the time when I saw something where I felt like they were just they were taking a position that wasn't, or that was very extreme, and it didn't take into account any nuance, I'd post something on it on both sides. So I posted some kind of pro conviction and pro not guilty comments, depending on it, on what it was, on either side, to different people that were very polarized, and just to see how they would respond. And I got an interesting response, wide variety of responses, surprisingly, on the internet. I know we're all surprised about that. There were quite a few people that were just that just responded angrily, or, you know, called me names. There was also some people that said, oh, that's interesting, I didn't know that. And then they would go on further and clarify. But the biggest thing that surprised me was how many people didn't know some of the key facts or circumstances going around, or some of the people that didn't seem to even care. And I could tell a lot of people were ingrained in specific opinions and didn't care either way. For instance, one person, I posted something. I posted why I thought there was an actual decent case for the manslaughter charge to this one person. And the response was all caps. He died of overdose of fentanyl, 100%. No questions asked, all in caps. Don't be an idiot. Something like that, which, of course, it's an oversimplification. And I had explained why it actually, for the manslaughter charge, it may not even matter if that was directly the cause. So I saw a lot of that, and a lot of people just really, really polarized on this. So I wanted to take a couple minutes and explain to people why this might be a big deal, or why there are even two sides to this argument. If you're one of the people that's just seen the clips of the video, or the clip of the video, what you see is you see almost 9 minutes of Derek Chauvin kneeling on the neck of George Floyd, or apparently kneeling on the neck of George Floyd. You hear him saying he can't breathe, and very, very sadly, you hear and see is kind of the life, what apparently it just seems like the life leaves him, and he dies. It's a very, very sad and tragic thing. You see the image you see all over the news is this one here, with, of course, him kneeling. You see here, for those of you who can't see, Derek Chauvin, he just has his knee right on his neck, his face is in the pavement, his eyes are closed, and the cop just has his hand in his pocket, kind of looking down at him. You also see other images where he's kind of just staring off blankly, and really the perception that's been put out there is that this cop just threw him on the ground, stuck his knee on his neck, and waited there for 9 minutes until he died. And that's it. And that's the story you get a lot of times. You get this, that was a death sentence. He murdered him. He had ill intent. He just wanted to kill him. He's a racist. All these things have been said. And there's a lot more to the videotape than just that. And that's really not where that's not the whole story. It's definitely a terrible look. And the whole situation is terrible as well. So I'm going to go through a brief summary for those of you that have only seen that clip. I'm going to go through a brief summary of kind of what happened. I encourage everyone to go watch the full 20-30 minute interaction that this takes place on, so you can understand the full context. I've watched it multiple times, although it is very hard to watch towards the end, because you do know somebody is dying in this clip. So I'm going to give you, those of you that don't have time for that, or don't want to stomach it, a summary of the situation. And some of this you'll have heard in the media, some of it you may not. It just depends on where you're getting your news source from. So long story short, you hear often that it was over a counterfeit bill. That is correct. So George Floyd, he went into a business. Again, this is all from what I've read, heard, what the bits I've come from the trial. I'm going to try to be as factual as possible. But so he went into a store. I believe he bought a pack of cigarettes. He was stumbling and acting a little weird, according to the clerk. From my understanding, he left the store and went and sat in his vehicle. The clerk found out that the bill he had was counterfeit. So he had passed a counterfeit bill. What you don't hear in the news as much, this came out more during the trial, is the clerk then went out to the vehicle and said, "Hey, this bill you passed me is counterfeit. Either return the cigarettes, or you know, we can return or change." Basically tried to give him the opportunity to make it right. He refused, according to what happened in the trial. Basically said, "No, I'm not going to do it, won't do it." The clerk tried, I believe, twice to do that with him, two different times going out to him. I believe he was going to let it slide. His manager basically didn't want him to. So he did what anyone would do. He called the police. And that's right there. That's where everything goes a little crazy. So the police arrive on scene. One of the first things, of course, is Floyd doesn't keep his hands where he can see him. He's not listening to the police officer when the police officer approaches the vehicle. He's being very non-compliant, I'll put it that way. And his hands are kind of all over the place. Things are going on. The officer's not comfortable with it. Obviously, he's telling him, put his hands on the steering wheel. I think later on he says, put his hands on his head, different things like that. Basically, keep your hands where I can see you. Floyd is not making a lot of sense to me. He's scared. He says he's been, you know, he basically says, "Don't shoot me, don't shoot me." He's obviously very scared. He says he lost his mother a while ago or something like that. He's very distraught. The whole thing, you can tell he's very, very scared. And so he does end up putting his hands where he can see him. And so the police officer, he reholsters his weapon. I didn't say he did. I do believe he pulled his weapon out. I don't think he aimed it directly at him. But he did do that when he was like fumbling away and his hands were in. So he puts it and he says, "Hey, I'm not going to shoot you. I'm not going to shoot you. It's okay. I'm not going to shoot you. Just keep your hands where I can see them," blah, blah, blah. He does try to de-escalate the situation, I'd say, quite well at that point. And he just says, "Hey, you know, I'm not going to, it's fine," tries to reassure him. There's a whole lengthy part here where Floyd's just, again, he's very fearful. He keeps talking about this, goes on about him shooting, all that. He's not cooperating. The officer ends up pulling him out of the vehicle, gets the other people out of the, they get the other vehicle out of the way as well. And it just kind of really goes downhill from there. I'm not going to go in again. I encourage you to watch the full video because I don't want to give any details that aren't accurate. But what really happens is Floyd is resisting. He's not being cooperative. He's kind of all over the place. So the officers end up cuffing him, which is, as a police officer, that is something you can do. That is considered a use of force. You can do it to somebody really for almost any reason. Normally what it is, it's for officer safety or the other person. So when somebody's being, in this case, it's a 6'6 person, I believe, very large individual. He's being chaotic, kind of not really listening, going all over the place. What he does is he places him in handcuffs. And that kind of escalates the situation a little bit because he's very talking about how he lost his mother, how all of this. He's very emotional and, again, not listening to commands. Things are going around. A lot more happens. The officer ends up trying to put him in the back of his vehicle. And as he puts him in the back of the vehicle, he starts complaining about being claustrophobic. Already he was saying he couldn't breathe through kind of the whole process. He's saying he can't breathe, he can't breathe, he can't breathe. As he's going to put him in the vehicle, he claims he is claustrophobic. From my perspective, what I see is, to me, it seemed more of a almost like a panic attack. type situation. I've had panic attacks in the past, and that is something that you can definitely start panicking. You can definitely do that. Confined spaces can do that. Ones you can't get out. So he's really panicking, saying he's claustrophobic, all of that. The officer's being fairly nice to someone who's resisting them, not letting him go in. He's saying he offered to like roll down the window, turn on the air. At one point, George Floyd says, don't leave me. Don't leave me. I don't want to be alone. So he says, hey, I'll stay with you. He does all that and really tries to get him in. And then he kind of halfway gets in the vehicle. He kind of went as he goes to put him, Floyd kind of lays in the seat. And then the other officer goes around and they're trying to get him in the vehicle. He opens the door. And from best I can tell, Floyd ends up kicking himself all the way almost out of the vehicle. One thing I forgot to mention that's a big kind of sticking point for a lot of people on one side is before he's in the vehicle, he's saying, can you just put – one of the things he said is, can you just put me on the ground? Just put me on the ground instead. So that's one thing he says. So as he kicks him out of the vehicle, that's when – kicks himself out of the vehicle. They end up – he's struggling. So they put him on – they do pin him against the ground. And that's the part where the pinning against the ground starts. From there, multiple officers are on him. You do see again that image that I showed before. This is where Derek Chauvin puts his knee on the back of his neck and his other knee on the back of his lower back, I believe. And the other officer tries to control his legs as he's kind of squirming around and doing that. So that's happening. Some other things that have already happened that I failed to mention. So in kind of this, I believe it was nearly 20 minutes, while they're struggling, trying to get him to cooperate, to get in the cop car, all of that. At some point or another, I believe he hit his nose. And so the officers call for EMS. A non-emergency call, as best as I can tell, or what they do is code 2. So it's an urgent call, but a non-emergency. Normally that means you're not using lights and sirens on your way. A couple minutes later, you do hear them again as the struggle's taking place. You hear them start to ask about drugs, things like that. They actually ask Floyd before kind of things got real flaky if he was on drugs. He said no. And so then a couple minutes after they make the initial call, the initial code 2 call, they escalate that from what I could tell to code 3 because they're worried about one, he's saying he can't breathe. And again, I actually don't know from the trial. This was their reasoning. This is my assumption based off of the videos I've done, and as well as they're concerned about his drug. Potential drugs and what's called excited delirium or an overdose. So they again, they start with a non-emergency call. So just it's urgent, get here. And a couple minutes later, they say, hey, something's seriously wrong other than just, a minor bloody nose or whatever happened during the scuffle. So let's get him over there. So as all this is transpiring, they know that they have they have EMS en route as an emergency and they should be there shortly. So back to this part, they're continuing to struggle. They throw him on the ground, or they place him on the ground, I should say. They put the knee on the neck and they're restraining him there. As all that's happening, he's still kind of struggling for a while. He's complaining he can't breathe, the famous, I can't breathe. And that goes on for, I believe it's nearly 9 minutes. So I think it's 8 minutes and 30 seconds. Don't quote me on that one. I'm sure the news source has the exact time frame, but it's a very long time that they have him there. As he does that, a couple of things that are of note and then I'll bring up is, at one point, the other officer there, not, Chauvin, says, hey, should we place him on the recovery position? I'll come back to that later. I believe he actually asked that twice, and they say no. Of course, the whole time he's on the ground, it started to draw a crowd now as they're on there. The crowd starts yelling. They're yelling at the officers. All kinds of stuff's going on. You can tell the officers are concerned. There's another officer or two there that are also trying to help control the crowd, keep them off. The crowd starts yelling to get off his neck. Floyd, again, is saying he can't breathe. The officers say, hey, you can talk. You're talking to me. You can breathe. It's okay. Things like that. That's a pretty common thing for I'm going to use a reference I know of, a panic attack. You feel like you can't breathe. You can talk. You can really breathe. You feel like you can't. So it's a common thing when people say, hey, you're talking, you can breathe. So the officers say that. They're reassuring them, hey, you're talking, you can breathe, you can breathe. And so it goes on. The crowd's more and more getting involved. They're more and more getting hostile. Eventually they do. He kind of stops struggling. He stops struggling, I believe, about 6.5 minutes in, something to that effect. And the last 2.5 minutes are him kneeling on his neck until EMS arrives. And that's one of my big sticking points, and I'll bring that there, is there, the 2.5 minutes, he's not really – he doesn't seem to be moving or any of that. The crowd's yelling at them, hey, you know, you're killing him. Get off his neck, get off his neck. I think someone says, hey, can you, you know, check his pulse, check his pulse. One of the officers does come over towards the end and checks his pulse. They don't say whether or not they felt the pulse or not. And then what happens is EMS finally arrives. They scoot him onto a stretcher, throw him in EMS, and leave. So that's the story. And it looks absolutely terribly terrible. Everything's going, especially when you're looking at it in the context of an officer just threw their knee and on them. And, you know, and that's they just waited until he died. So a couple things going on here. That's kind of the narrative of the story. A few other facts come out, of course. The store clerk did mention he was acting erratic. It did turn out that he had both fentanyl and meth in his system. He had a several times over lethal dose of fentanyl in his system. So that was one factor that we'll talk about in a little bit. A lot of people say that doesn't matter. A lot of people say that does matter. So that's one factor that came out. Another thing that's actually a lesser known or not as reported thing is the ambulance came, did a scoop and go. Basically, they grabbed him. They moved 3 blocks away, and then they started to try to resuscitate him. Assuming what the common assumption is now, I don't think they've interviewed the EMS just yet. Perhaps I'm mistaken. The assumption there is basically the EMS didn't think the scene was safe. They were afraid of being attacked by the crowd that was going up there. And so they actually went a couple blocks away and tried to resuscitate him. And by all accounts, he was dead already. So that's what's going on. Really, what it is, it's a very long event. What you do see in the beginning is, and this doesn't excuse anything towards the end, what you see in the beginning is an officer, for the most part, being fairly patient, I would say, with an individual that's not complying and is kind of pulling away, trying to get away, doing all of that, being what we would call, I would say, passive resistant, but it was actually active. He's kind of pulling away and going at it and a lot of that stuff. So he's very resistant, mildly resistant, I would say, individual. And you see them for very, very long time trying to deal with him. And you see some attempts to de-escalate the situation. You see things like, hey, I'm not going to shoot you. I'm not going to shoot you. Things like that. You did see them ask, hey, you know, are you on any drugs? Which, again, if I'm a criminal that's on drugs, I'm probably not going to answer the cops on that one. But they did say, hey, is there something going on here? They tried to give him that opportunity to say that. That way they could call EMS. You know, he offered to roll the window down for him in the confined space, all of that. So for a lot of times you see them trying within pretty good reason, trying to make him comfortable, trying to do some of the stuff. And then, of course, towards the end, you see him there on the ground. It's just there. They're restraining him. So the charges brought forth, I believe there's several of them. There's a couple variations of murder that they're bringing forward for Derek Chauvin, as well as a manslaughter charge. And I would encourage you to go look at one of the channels that breaks down what's actually required to prove those charges. In my personal opinion, there is that what the situation in no way meets the murder charges. And I think there's a really good case, or there's a decent case for bringing a manslaughter charge. If I was a prosecutor, based off of my limited knowledge or my current limited knowledge of the law, I would have probably brought a manslaughter charge case to that. I think the rest is an overreach, and I'll go into that in a second. So what you're seeing now is two sides with a big, big disagreement and a big thing we're seeing. So there's the side that says this was a murder. He intentionally, he's a racist. He, you know, he tried to kill him. He wanted to kill him. There's that point of view. Another point of view is, you know, this cop is just a terrible cop and he was grossly negligent and cold-hearted and he killed him that way. And that's more of a kind of what the manslaughter normally does. There's that point of view. And then another point of view that you're hearing a lot is that there's a whole section of people that are very, very, very closely focusing on that. I believe it's three times the normally lethal amount of fentanyl in his system that was on the toxicology report. And they're saying that's what killed him, not the knee on the neck. So let's get into this just a wee bit. And here's why I'm going to say I think there's some good cases on either side. What I don't think you can say is this is by any chance premeditated or even intentional murder. There is no evidence that I've seen to date that there was any ill will towards him, there was any malice, or that this was intentional. So I'm going to go ahead and just state that. So for all of you out there that are just saying, you know, he was out there to murder him because he was black or because he knew him from somewhere else or something like that, I would encourage you to look for some evidence of that. Feel free if you find some to post it. But at this point, I have yet to see any actual evidence that there was malice or that this was intentional. This wasn't an intentional murder. It definitely wasn't premeditated. One of the biggest arguments that you see a lot is, okay, he did something grossly negligent, meaning putting the knee on the neck, and he left it there for a very long period of time. He should have known that that would have killed him. The crowd was telling him that it killed him, all of that. And that's one of the big arguments you hear. And there's some merit in that, especially when it comes to the manslaughter charge. So one of the big things that's going on right now in the trial is they're trying to show that. They're trying to show that that the knee contributed to his death and made it worse. So that's one point of view. And then again, the other point of view is more, well, he had a lethal dose of fentanyl and fentanyl caused it. And the knee on the neck was either a minor thing or it wasn't even a contributing factor because he would have died anyway and because really what is done. So let's get a few things straight here. Again, I want to reiterate the I can't breathe thing was not isolated to the knee on the neck. That happened all throughout. One of the things that I'm seeing argued about a lot is the claustrophobia claim, and people really are digging into that and arguing about his claustrophobia claim, getting into there. And they're trying to use that to make him be a liar or something like that, or paint him in a bad light, and really getting stuck on this claustrophobia claim. And they're getting stuck on that saying, well, he was in a front seat of a small car right before. And then when they put him in the back, he's conveniently claustrophobic. One thing I want to say that is that's a thing. Is people say, oh, it's convenient claustrophobia. One person I saw in a video, they commented like they knew somebody, I think it was their mother or something, that they would get claustrophobic in the back seat of a car, but not the front seat. One thing I wanted to say is, and then one person said, oh, so selective claustrophobia. I would say, one, that this doesn't really matter to this conversation, whether or not he was claustrophobic, but I do want to bring some awareness to, especially when it comes to panic attacks or being out of control, things like that. You definitely can feel claustrophobic. You feel like you want to get out of there. You feel like you can't breathe. Normally it's for things that don't make sense. So when people say, well, selective claustrophobia, my point, one of the things I brought up is it's not really selective claustrophobia. It's more a panic attack. I have had them in the past, and they have nearly always been from a lack of control, from feeling trapped, things like that. So it was definitely something seeing that I could feel and relate to that. And what it is basically panic attacks. For those of you that don't know, they normally start with a small, they can start with a small fear. Sometimes they don't even make any sense at all. It's something that you know in your mind it isn't real. I'll give you an example. I had them once in a barber chair because I felt trapped and felt like it wasn't socially acceptable to move. You have the little thing around your neck. It was a little tight. You're afraid you can't breathe. And it's something that you know that's dumb. You know you're fine. You know nothing's going to happen. But just that feeling, knowing that you can't easily leave, that it's there, you start worrying. And when you have a panic attack, the worry just builds up. And what happens is you start worrying, at least for me, the heart would start beating fast. You start feeling really hot. You feel like you can't really breathe. And again, all of this comes in it. You feel almost like you're going to die, even though you know that it's not true. And almost always that feeling is you want to get out of there. You want to escape. You want to go away. And that's something I pointed out in that comment, even though that's, again, this argument over whether or not he had claustrophobia or whether or not it was a panic attack or if it was something else. It doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things, because if you're having a panic attack, you're having a panic attack, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to get arrested that day. And it's not saying that nobody would ever fake a panic attack to try to get out of being arrested. And, you know, just the matter of being arrested is likely to give someone a panic attack. So with that, I wanted to say that is absolutely a thing, that selective claustrophobia. Really, I would say in that case, it's not claustrophobia, it's more of a panic attack. But by far the easiest way to explain it to somebody is claustrophobia. I've done it in the past where you're like, you know, you don't want to be in that. It's trapped in a confined space, because then you'll be afraid of it, because you're afraid of getting a panic attack. A lot of times with panic attacks, you start getting afraid of having a panic attack because you've had one in that situation before. That fear spirals out of control, and it starts that whole cycle, the fast heartbeat, feeling like you can't breathe, feeling hot, all of that. And it really just goes from there. And again, it doesn't necessarily make sense. So I kind of talked about that a little bit. I did want to bring that to some people's attention just because it's not something that makes sense. And somebody absolutely can be claustrophobic, or in this case, a panic attack or that fear of control, you know, in the back of a police car, which I've been in the back of one. It's not comfortable and you're trapped back there. Whereas when you're in the driver's seat of your own vehicle, you feel like, you know, you can pull over anytime. You can jump out anytime. So there is a difference there. That is something, again, I think that has absolutely no bearing on the case for Derek Chauvin. It doesn't really matter in the long run, but again, it's something I wanted to bring up because it's a common point of topic. The other big thing that you'll hear one side latch onto is that, again, the massive amount of drugs in the system, between that and the I can't breathe in the vehicle. It's quite clear from at least the toxicology reports and all of that thing that he was under not just the toxicology reports, but also the reports on scene, even the camera footage. You can see that he's likely under the influence of something. The police officers also discuss that. You can see that there's a lot going on there, which if you are overdosing or things like that, there's something called excited delirium, where you absolutely don't kind of make sense. You can be really strong. All kinds of things happen. And you can feel like you can't breathe, like your heart's pounding out of your chest, like you're going to have a heart attack, all of those things. And so a lot of people say, well, he had that, obviously it was excited delirium. Well, it's 100% that. Nothing the officer did matters. So not guilty. This is a witch hunt. He's just not guilty. And like that one person said, 100% drug induced. So I want to take a moment and just play the devil's advocate for this, and try, if you're one of those people, I want you to understand where at least some people are coming from, or a good portion of the people. So when you have somebody in custody, and here I'm going to talk about, they've apprehended him, he's in handcuffs, he's on the ground, you have a duty of care to the person, which means you do have to take care of them. They are in your custody. So you do have a duty of care. And what the big thing that concerned me, or the big thing I saw, the biggest argument I think where there's some merit, or there's a good case, is you see all that. They got him on the ground. They're on him. Sure, he's been saying he can't breathe the whole time, even when he's that. They hear him breathing. They're good to go. They know he's breathing. They can see, feel him breathing. He's talking. He's still wiggling around. They know he's probably suffering from that excited delirium. They know they have EMS en route. And they're doing all that. My biggest problem is that last about 2.5-3 minutes where he stops moving, he stops responding, and they just stay there. During that time or right before, you also hear one of the officers say, hey, should we move them into the recovery position? I mentioned this before. So one of the things that's not widely reported is at one point, and in the training manual that was available at that time, there was a knee on the neck restraining method that was in the manual for police officers to use that quite clearly demonstrates the knee on the neck, and it was labeled as a maximum control position. One of the ways it was used was for excited delirium. This was something that they were, in theory, allowed to do. We heard in the trial several times that it wasn't a trained position, meaning they didn't go out and train that. They didn't think Chauvin was trained in that. And I believe the manual says you had to be trained in it to use it. So it was a position that was trained and used. So up until a certain point, you say, hey, this is a good position. And then what it says is once, you know, they're here, when it's available, move them to the recovery position. And so you hear this other officer say, hey, should we move them to the recovery position? This officer that had been on duty for, I think, 4 days and asked him that. And Chauvin says basically the effect of no. I think they asked twice, if I'm not mistaken. And he says no. And they just kind of hold him there until EMS arrives. And that's where I think the manslaughter charge has some merit. Hear me out here. I understand that if you're one of those ones that said, well, he was going to die from fentanyl, here's the thing. They know he's on drugs. They suspect he's on drugs. They suspect him of excited delirium, possible overdose. And he stops breathing, he stops moving. He stops struggling. Your partner is saying, hey, we should probably move him into the recovery position, like our manual says, to let him recover. You hear the crowd saying, take your knee off his neck. You're killing him. You're doing all of this. My argument is, hey, wouldn't a reasonable person just take your knee off his neck, check to see, make sure he has a pulse and all that? Again, one of them did eventually check for a pulse. I don't know if they felt one or not. You know, to me, it seems reasonable that you would do that. And you have that duty of care. So if somebody stops breathing, if they're doing that, absolutely the right thing to do if there's no pulse is they need to uncuff him and start CPR. And that's the argument there. One of the arguments that the prosecutors are making is there was quite clearly he had a duty of care. Even if he was dying of his own overdose and what you were doing has no effect, you have that duty of care. When he stops breathing, you should have started the chest compressions and started doing that. And basically that potentially could have saved his life. So you were negligent, didn't do what you were supposed to do. You didn't meet your duty of care. And so you drastically lowered his chances of living. I believe it's something like this was testified in the trial by one of the doctors. I think it was somewhere between 10 and 14% chance. Your chances of dying after your heart stops goes up 10 to 14% for every minute that you don't do chest compressions. And we're talking about, I think, 3-4 minutes here between that time and the time the ambulance arrives. So that's kind of the manslaughter case, is it's gross negligence that contributed to his death. Is you didn't provide that duty of care. You didn't do that. You still kept doing the knee on the neck thing. Again, whether or not you feel that contributed to that. So even if he overdosed, you didn't do your job. You didn't do it properly, and you had a disregard for his life and just kind of just let him die. And so that's where the manslaughter charge, there is an argument for that. And I want people to think about that for a little bit, because that is something you would expect a police officer to do. If you know somebody's dying, even if it's something they did themselves, let's say you accept that it's 100% a fentanyl overdose and the knee on the neck did nothing. You would still want them. They still have that duty of care. They still try to revive you. Now, there's this is where I'm going to kind of break off, and I'm going to show the other side of the argument a little bit as well. You do have that duty of care. You have to do it when possible and when it's safe. And this is where some of the stuff starting coming out in the trial now. One of the things is the scene has to be safe, and it has to be safe to actually provide care. One of the people I follow, this is an actual lawyer, and I highly recommend you check him out. If you go to the Law of Self-Defense, there's a YouTube channel. He also has a blog. I think it's just lawofselfdefense.com. Some of his stuff is paid content. Very good stuff. He's been covering this trial. He's been giving daily updates of the trial. It's very good, very legal-minded. What he does is he is a self-defense lawyer. He knows this type of law. He very well, overall, he's, I'd say, very logical. Definitely is a defense lawyer. So in this case, I think he looks at things from definitely from the defensive perspective. So he looks at how someone could get off or why the law doesn't apply. But I'd highly recommend it. I went off on a little trail here, but one of the things he brought up is, yeah, it has to be safe. And the scene was debatably not safe. So what you have here is you have a riled up crowd, a crowd making threats, calling the police names, increasingly getting angry at them. I believe one of them even had to be restrained. It was a very chaotic situation. And so one of the things you have to take into account when you're evaluating all of these is what they call the totality of circumstances. So all of the factors that are going on around the police officer, everything that's happening, and then you're only supposed to take into account the information they know. So what the police officers know here is they have a large crowd, very angry crowd, a threatening crowd, a crowd that could definitely turn violent. They have a large individual that's down, possibly overdosed. With that, they know that to do CPR, they would have to uncuff him. And one of the things that came out in the court is they've been trained that it's very likely when with an overdose victim or something like that, if you resuscitate them, they will become violent again. And then what the police officers also know is that they know any minute the ambulance is arriving. They had placed the call quite a while ago. From what I've saw, the ambulance response was slower than expected, or what I heard. I haven't seen numbers to quantify that or even prove that. But so to them, ambulance is just around the corner. The ambulance will be able to provide them with the best care they can. Another thing the ambulance have, this is the law of self-defense individual argues this a lot. The ambulance carries, according to him, they carry a very powerful sedative specifically for these cases. So when you revive the person, they quite often, especially when they're under excited delirium or something like that, they get violent. They give them the sedative and it makes it safer for both the individual and everyone around them. So the argument there is that the scene likely wasn't safe. So at that point, they couldn't uncuff him. They couldn't give him chest compressions without endangering themselves and others. I think there's an argument there. Obviously, in hindsight, you look at it and you go, oh, of course you should uncuff them. In hindsight, knowing what you know now, of course, the officers didn't have that luxury of the hindsight. So, you know, I can understand that argument that it may not have been safe. One of the things that was presented in the evidence as well to contributing thing is the ambulance got there. Normally what you do is they start chest compressions or they start providing aid immediately on scene, basically do it immediately, and then you move them into the ambulance and take them back. What the ambulance did instead is they decided to just scoop them up, throw them in the gurney, move them in the ambulance, and then they drove, I believe, two or three blocks away, stopped, and then started trying to resuscitate him two or three blocks away. And the reason for that, apparently, again, was they didn't feel safe on site. Even with the police officers there, they didn't feel safe. They were, and this came out in trial, they said, yeah, there's been cases where ambulances have been attacked, things like that. So even the EMS members didn't feel safe on site providing CPR on site in that environment with all of the officers providing cover for him. So that's some evidence that shows that it's possible that officers thinking it's not safe to provide CPR or for the officers not to do it
that might have been reasonable. And I'm not here to necessarily agree with that or disagree with that at this point. I think that's really up to the jury. For me to make that determination, I'd love to hear some of this actual evidence. The best I can tell is there was quite a bit. The defense was definitely winning that one on cross-examination from what I heard. That's what I wanted to say there. There's really two sides to that, and I think a reasonable person could take either position, knowing all the facts, could take either position. And what I think it's important to do is to, at this point, trust the system where the jury are getting all of the facts, and what they're going to have to do is place themselves in the position of an officer that's there. They have a resistant suspect that's large, one that they know might be violent when they comes back up. They know in this case, all the officer would know is that the ambulance was just moments around the corner. They're better trained, better equipped to handle this. And to think if it was reasonable to make the decision to not provide that care or to delay that care for a few minutes. I think that's, again, a reasonable person could come up with either decision. And I think leaving that up to the jury of the individual's peers would be is the best thing to do, according to our legal system. With that, I did want to address something else, is the knee on the neck thing. I probably should address that first. A knee to the neck like that, and like what he's doing, is not the death sentence the media made it out to be. I want to be quite clear there. This is for any of those people that haven't done extensive like wrestling, submission wrestling, things like that. By in and of itself, by itself, it is, with no other factors, it's not a death sentence. You're not going to choke somebody out and kill them just by putting a little bit or even a lot of pressure on the backside of the neck like was done there. That's just not how choking works. So that's kind of why I didn't talk about a lot of this. It looks really bad. And to people that don't understand the mechanics of chokes, it looks really bad. It seems like he just choked him out and killed him. There are two different types of chokes. In the trial, they haven't done a good job distinguishing between these two. There's two different types of chokes. You learn these in jiu-jitsu, any submission, combat sports. There's air chokes and blood chokes. So what you can do is if you cut off the airway to the individual, these normally take a little bit longer. If you cut off the airway, the body doesn't get oxygen, you pass out. The other way is you can do what's called a blood choke. And in this case, you have two arteries on the side of your neck, the carotid arteries. If you cut off the blood flow there by compressing that, it actually doesn't take much pressure on both sides. You can actually choke somebody out in a matter of seconds. And that's what we'd call, I'm sure there's a medical term for it. It's a blood choke. You could argue potentially that, or some people are trying to argue that the knee on the neck was a blood choke. Not really. I would say that it's not likely. In my opinion, as someone that's done jiu-jitsu or did jiu-jitsu for several years, first off, the artery is more on the front, and as any jiu-jitsu practitioner should know, for a blood choke, you really have to get both arteries. You have to take both arteries, compress them, and if you do fully compress them, it's a matter of seconds. And that's another thing that I keep hearing said, though, that another piece of extreme stuff that I'm trying to do is I hear a lot of this. Well, if you can breathe or if you can talk, you can breathe. If you can talk, there's no choke. That's not necessarily true. I would say most of the time that's true. A wind choke, if you can talk, you probably can make it through. A blood choke, there are times where you can get choked slowly. If it's not quite right, it's not fully depressing both of the arteries here. It can absolutely constrict blood flow to your brain, and it can be a much slower process and take a lot longer. This has happened to me in jiu-jitsu. It happens quite a bit. At least it happened quite a bit to me, especially with one or two partners. They had a couple chokes they were pretty bad at, and you kind of defend it, and you get in there, and you get a little space to basically get your arteries a little space. And what'll happen is it'll kind of compress it, and you don't get full flow to on either side, and it's a very long, drawn out process, and you can pass out. If something like that happens, you can definitely talk. At least I could. You could talk, and yet it still could, in theory, be choking you enough to I would assume, I'm not a medical doctor, kill you if held for a very, very long time, including after the time you passed out. However, with that, you really do have to cut off both sides. To my knowledge, I've never seen it done with only one carotid artery cut off. You have the whole other one. You're very good. You're good. Other complicating factors, of course, would be things like when you're struggling, you use more energy, like he was. So when you're struggling, you use up a lot more of that oxygen. So you could definitely pass out a lot easier with a worse choke or less constriction. But again, I'm not seeing the knee on the neck, which is more towards the back of the neck. I'm making an assumption here. A few of you, if you're well-informed, may try to correct me, I guess, and say that the knee wasn't on his neck. One of the things that came out of the trial as well is they showed two camera angles to, I believe it was the police chief. One was from the phone that, you know, it's the famous angle, the one I showed before. It shows what appears to be the knee on the neck. And then they showed the actual police body cam footage. And the one they says, where is the knee here? It's the knee's on the neck. And then they say, here's the exact same moment, but this is the footage from the cop's body cam. Where is the knee? Is it on his shoulder? And it says, yeah, it looks like it's on his shoulder. So a lot of people are taking this one moment in time, and they're really trying to debate that it was on his shoulder. It was on his shoulder. Again, I don't think it matters. And I don't think, based off of that one blurry image, you should necessarily discount the whole images that we've seen from the other angle or how it looks or how it appears. So I'm kind of putting all of that to the side. I'm assuming that the knee was on the neck. But again, the way it was on the neck, back of the neck, your arteries are in the front. I just don't see it being very likely that that was any type of choke. That said, another thing that is trained, or another thing that is coming up from the prosecution, is something called positional asphyxiation. This is a, from my understanding, fairly rare phenomenon. It happens where people that are handcuffed in police custody on their stomach for long periods of time, they die unexplainably. The theory behind this is that what happens is basically when you're sitting on their chest or their knee on the chest or something like that, that they can't take the full breaths. So their chest can't expand fully, so they don't get as much oxygen, and so they pass away. That one, at least from the way it was taught to me back when I was in, it's one rare. Oftentimes you're more concerned about that if there's other complicating factors. And there's a lot of debate currently on whether or not it's even a real thing. Now, what definitely is a real thing is there are cases where people have died in police custody like that, and they don't have a good explanation. But oftentimes they're complicating factors, things like drugs. I believe another one of them that I was taught, again, this was at least 8 years ago. I got out 8 years ago and stopped doing it over 8 years ago. I believe another one was if you're pepper sprayed, it gets in your lungs and all that. And then if you leave them prone face down too long, that was another one that put them at greater risks. But drugs, other things like that contribute to it. The science is kind of mixed on that one. One of the institutes did a lot of research on that, and they really don't think it's a real thing. They think that the deaths are caused by something else that's explainable. But anyway, that's one of the things that's coming into a play a lot with the prosecution. A lot of police officers, a lot of departments are trained about this. I know it was something that was mentioned to me, and that's why you see the things like the recovery position. And here you can definitely see 9 minutes. They left him on his stomach with somebody on his back. But I think that's a pretty weak case because, one, it's an extremely rare event, and two, one thing that the defense has shown a good job is it's much more likely, at least from what the defense has shown from the medical expert's testimony, all those same symptoms, it can also be explained by the drug overdose, the shortness of breath, the way it kills through asphyxiation is also directly explained by the drug overdose. So anyway, That's my take on it. So again, pretty complicated. In my mind, the murder charges, he is very, 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 very unlikely to be found guilty of, assuming the exact letter of the law is followed. And based off of the current evidence that I've seen, very, very unlikely. I think there's a case to be made for the manslaughter. By the day, as they make their case and as the different people are testifying, including, you know, the EMS talking about how the scene may or may not be safe. The police trainer talked about one of the actual police trainers talked about using that technique themselves, for until EMS came in one case. So there's been a lot of things that are shown where this basically isn't as bad as it looks. So overall, I think he's unlikely to be convicted of definitely of any kind of murder, of manslaughter. I think there's a case to be made there. So far, I do not think the prosecution has made that case. And I think the defense has left holes in their story a mile wide with reasonable doubt. So do I think they're proving beyond a reasonable doubt right now that he committed manslaughter? No. That's my personal opinion. Again, as I said earlier, I do think there's a good case, or a reasonable person looking at all the facts could come to a different conclusion. I would encourage people to spend a little time research both sides. That's one of the things that I'm not seeing a lot of people doing online with the comments, is they're shoeholing themselves into their one opinion, and they're reading all the stuff that backs up their opinion, namely mostly the mainstream media. And they're not necessarily looking for the other explanations, trying to understand the officer procedures. They're trying to understand whether or not, you know, this was actually in the handbook, whether or not it was, as the police chief said, it wasn't taught. But again, the actual self-defense teacher said they've used the position before, or a similar position, I should say. So again, I'm trying to prepare people to understand that this is not a clear-cut case of like intentional murder. I see there's very, very, very likely to be a lot of upset when this trial is over. Not everyone has time to dig into all of the, you know, all of the conversations that are happening, the evidence. What I'm seeing a lot is mainstream media focusing very much on the prosecution's case, on the very small wins the prosecution makes, because normally the way it works is the prosecution right now, they're calling up witnesses. They're kind of asking them very, very narrow questions. And so they're answering that, and they're giving them answers that, of course, look bad for Chauvin. And then what's happening is later on, or of course afterwards, the defense gets to cross-examine them. So they add the nuance or the detail or the background or even the other positions in there, and that makes it realize that it's actually not as bad as the prosecution made it sound by putting it out of context. For instance, one of the things brought up is they're liking to hammer exactly, is this read this policy, exactly what's highlighted. And evidently, at least according to the law of self-defense person, they're leaving out a lot of the words or sections that say, you know, this is our policy, assuming it is safe, or assuming that the scene will, or assuming that, because nearly everything in police, you have to take in that totality of the circumstances, see if it is safe, it's a good idea. There are situations where this policy wouldn't actually apply, where you can discount the policy. Basically, all the policies are conditional. Policing really is about what a reasonable officer would do in that situation, given only the facts that they know at that time. And the courts have held that up many, many, many times, because really, especially in this situation, this was a very, very complex, difficult situation. Especially in the first beginning, when things are happening and as the crowds start coming in, and evidently it was right next to a pretty busy street, and there's just all kinds of stuff going on. There's different things that are being said. There are other people threatening the police. There's so many things the police officers have to take into account. Now, that said, I also think it's not that hard for when he stops struggling and the crowd's yelling at you to take your knee off his neck, take your knee off the neck. I still think Chauvin is a could have made better choices. At a minimum, I think he is. I don't think he was a very intelligent person at that time. Now, perhaps that's because he'd been dealing with somebody trying to be nice for 20 minutes and he was exhausted and didn't make a good decision. I don't really care, to be honest. There's definitely a case to say he wasn't a very... he didn't make smart choices, as we would tell our kids, make smart choices. I don't think he made a smart choice at all in that situation. But at this point, I'm not seeing a good case for calling a murderer. I haven't seen any evidence yet that this was actually race-based. Not yet. Now, perhaps I'm wrong. Feel free to add that in the comments or send me an email, dialoguenotdivision@gmail.com. This is a long story short, big long rant. Or not really rant, explanation. What I want you to get from that is please, please do just look into both sides. Realize that this was a very complex situation. Realize that the actual law involved, that this is actually a borderline case. And it's not as clear cut as either the media made it. What I was trying to say earlier is the media seems to focus on the wins for the prosecution, but they're not really focusing on the wins for the defense. And the defense, especially in the last couple of days, have had a lot of very, very significant wins. They have had a lot of the state's own witness, meaning the prosecution's witnesses, they're calling, basically testify in ways that are actually really good to them because they ask them a question. And really what you're seeing is that the prosecution is trying to stretch this case to be more than it is. What I mean by that is I don't think murder legally fits this case. I think that this should have been tried as a manslaughter case, in my personal opinion. So again, understand there's a possibility that this goes to a not guilty verdict, and understand that doesn't make necessarily the system racist. That doesn't mean that what happened wasn't tragic. This doesn't mean that Derek Chauvin shouldn't be fired. This doesn't mean any of that. What it does mean is that this is a very complicated situation, that there were many, many factors that it likely wasn't, that knee to the neck likely wasn't a direct It wasn't a direct cause. Whether or not it was a contributing factor is being debated. So please don't get too upset about this. Prepare yourself for either verdict. And don't get too wrapped up in one side or another. Read a little bit about both sides. Try to understand both sides. And I would encourage you to try to pull some people towards the middle, as this is a very polarizing issue right now. Or I should say there's a lot of people that think that if he's not found guilty and sentenced to life, that the system failed. And I would encourage you to have discussions with people that feel that way, that are open to rational thought. Just expand their mind with a few facts if they're willing to listen. And hopefully educate them in that. Again, if you have thoughts, feel free to put them in this video. If I misstated something, if I got something wrong, please do put a comment, send an email to dialoguenotdivision. I am trying to make these as factual as possible, or when it's something that I'm assuming or I've heard, I'm trying to say that. I highly encourage you to go check out the Law of Self-Defense's videos on this topic. He has daily videos where he goes through and he kind of summarizes the prosecution and defense. I think those are excellent videos. So, other than that, I know it's a pretty hard topic to talk about. We're not ending on a happy note. It's something that's very sad that happened. A life was lost, but I did really want people to try to use this as a coming together time. And if we want to talk about reform in police, I think that's perfectly fine. What I don't want to do is to use this individual as kind of the scapegoat for all of police, try to send him to jail for the rest of his life or over something that I think your problem is with the actual police department that had this in the manual. I think that your problem may be with some of the policies, maybe with some of the methods for policing, but I wouldn't take that on this individual. We can absolutely have conversation about police reform. I do believe, personally, I believe that most police officers are good people. I think they have good intentions. I think they make mistakes. I think there are some police officers out there that are terrible people. I experienced in my time in military police, I experienced some cops that I didn't think I didn't think were good people. We'll put it that way. I didn't like the culture around it. I thought there was a lot of room for improvement with the culture. It wasn't something that fit my personality very well, which is why I got out. And so I would absolutely agree with anyone that says that there are big steps that we could take to improve policing. I would, again, I would agree with that, but let's not turn this into turn this situation into something more than it is. Let's stay objective and reasonable. Try to understand the facts. And well, that's all I have for you. There won't be a show next week. I will be on vacation, spending some time in the woods next week. We'll pick it up the week after that. Thank you, everyone, and have a great week.